and stuff in it. So you, but if you scan it, you can, you know, edit those out, I'm sure.
Yes.
Do you have a picture of May and Eddie together?
Is it that picture that was shown?
That Jim Wood showed?
Yeah.
Yeah, that, yeah. I've got
Do
that
you
on
have
the,
that?
Yeah, on the computer. That's where he got it.
Okay.
I can email you that.
Sure, that'd be lovely. All right. I want,
just a minute.
Sorry.
Okay.
I'm just Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L,
yeah,
at RPI.
Okay, so I got, now where was your review of the of Marsha Meldon?
It's just coming out. The reason I thought of that.
Where will it be coming out?
The Bulletin of the History of Medicine.
Do you have a reprint of that you could send me?
Yeah, well, it's not. It's. I just looked at proofs just before I left, so it's just coming out. Quite favorable review because, you know, there's so little in this area.
Yeah.
Now, I wanted to go back to something that you said. I want to do the opiate total synthesis.
Yeah.
But I wanted to go back to something that you said at the very beginning.
Yeah.
Which was, I knew how to make compounds very well, but I didn't know why I was making them. And to have you talk more at a sort of level of generality about how you learned why you were making them and the sort of process by which you came to think about why you were making them.
Okay. Let me see if there was one. Oh, yeah. The other thing is, if you want to know more about Bentley's work,
mm-hmm.
Bentley was making the more complex compounds.
Yes.
One of my former postdocs is here at the meeting. His name is Andy Koop. Now Andy is the successor to Arthur Jacobson on the Drug Evaluation Committee. So Andy is only the fourth coordinator for that group after Dr. Eddie, Dr. May, Arthur Jacobson, and Andy Koop. Well, Andy Koop worked for John Lewis, got his PhD under John Lewis, who developed buprenorphine, who was in Bentley's group. Bentley's still alive.
In Britain?
Yeah. And you can find Bentley's address. Do you, I guess you can probably pull it up under Medline, or he writes a review article every year for the Journal of the Chemical Society Reviews. I think that's what they still call it. Let me see if I can. You want me to find?
Yeah,
Bentley?
If I've thought about doing more of a history of buprenorphine specifically, and so if I turn out to do that project, I'll.
You could do a nice thing on the history of a complete history of the chemical the chemistry too.
Mm-hmm.
Of the, I mean, you might need some help.
I was going to say I'm not sure I'm up for it because of the chemistry background that you'd need to carry that off well.
Mm-hmm.
But
well, let me think about that. Maybe. Anyhow, okay, let's do this right now. Bentley's. I'll get Bentley's address, but he would have some stuff to probably have some stuff to tell you, or at least Andy. You know, Andy can get you Bentley's address also.
Yes. Okay.
About how that program was designed and how it was Bentley designed it and how he set it up and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is Kenneth Bentley. Okay. You want me? Let's see how I became. A medicinal chemist after being starting as an organic chemist, basically.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I always had an interest in medicinal chemistry, but I didn't really know much about it. My thesis was on streptomycin,
mm-hmm.
an antibiotic, of course, and I worked for the drug company, Ciba Geigy, for a while. But then when I got to Everett May's group, I realized I didn't know anything about it, basically. I didn't even know what a synapse was. That's the
yes.
where the nerve cells talk to one another. And this is interesting because just about the time I entered May's group is when, the, 1 year before, the opiate receptor, had then singular, had been published in Science by Perton Snyder,
yes.
by Terenius, and by that other guy, Eric...
Solomon.
Hmm?
Solomon?
That's Solomon Snyder you're thinking of.
Oh. Are you... And you're not talking about Kosterlitz, Eric
no,
Simon.
Kosterlitz is the guy that
right.
discovered the endogenous ligands.
Simon? Is it Eric Simon?
Eric Simon, that's
yeah.
it, right. He used etorphine as his ligand. So then then everybody in May's group and started thinking about, now you know this is what these drugs do. They interact with this receptor. So what we started doing, thinking about then, is how can we figure out how they interact with the receptor? And how can we characterize this receptor? And learn more about it from a biochemical standpoint. So we were, at that time, collaborating with a guy at NIH named Werner Klee. And so... one of the goals of this research was purifying the opiate receptor to homogeneity, pure protein purification to homogeneity. And Werner had a system where what was then the delta receptor, there was some evidence for multiplicity of opiate receptors at that time.
Yes.
But they hadn't been fully, completely demonstrated.
Would you attribute that to Martin?
Hmm?
Martin?
Yeah. He was the first to say in 1967 in Pharmacologic Reviews, he was the first to say these actions that I see in the chronic spinal dog must be attributable to different types of opioid receptors, and I'm going to call one of them the mu receptor because this is the effects that morphine produce. I'm going to call another one the kappa receptor because this is what is produced by ketocyclazosine. Similar to what we were talking about earlier. And then he's going to call the other one the sigma receptor. And the sigma receptor is interesting. Are you got the tape on?
I do.
Yeah, okay. So, because you couldn't possibly write this fast.
No. I only write so that my transcriber can keep a track of
okay.
the structure. So I'm not trying to keep up with you.
Okay. So the sigma receptor... was the sigma receptor that Martin postulated was thought to be an opiate receptor because the ligand they were using was a compound called SKF10047, which is a benzomorphan, of which Everett May was one of the authors on the original paper, along with some guys from Smith, Klein, and French Company. They got into, this is one illustration of, shall we go into this business about these heterogeneity
of the receptors?
Yeah.
Yeah, but remember that the question you're answering is the why you went.
Oh, okay.
In this direction.
So I went in that direction. So the sigma receptor turned out not to be an opiate receptor. What he was seeing was a receptor was the effects. He was using the mixture of mirror images to study as his primary ligand. So he was seeing effects from the minus isomer, from the left-handed form, and he was seeing a multiplicity of effects from the right-handed form. And this took about 10 years to unravel. And then later the delta receptor was discovered by pharmacologic measurements by Kosterlitz, because he had to, after he isolated these peptides, he had to explain what they were interacting with in the brain as in their natural state, and they had evidence then for the third type of receptor, the delta receptor, and all of these have been cloned now. But how I got into this was, and started learning something about pharmacology was when we were trying to figure out how to trying to make a drug to label the receptor. And so the label would stay on it during the purification.
Mm-hmm.
And what we did, was to start putting, we started taking opiate ligands and putting reactive functional groups on them that could form a covalent bond with the receptor. These are also known as affinity labels. So the drug, it's a two-stage process. The drug binds to the receptor, and then this reactive functional group on the receptor. Now forms a covalent bond, so they can't separate. So if you've got this, if you've got the drug label with tritium, then you have a non-reversible tritium label on the receptor. Okay, so we my approach to that was to take the most potent opioids known to man at the time, and use diverse structures, and do the synthetically simplest thing first. One of the ones we chose was etonitazine, that compound that we talked about earlier. This compound has a nitro functional group in it, which was easily convertible to an isothiocyanate function, which formed a covalent bond with the mu receptor. Then we took fentanyl, which is a mu ligand. With fentanyl, when you put an isothiocyanate group in the paraposition of the phenethyl group, binds to mu reversibly, but it binds irreversibly to delta. And this was a real surprise. So I had to begin to understand binding at that point. I had to begin, and I started thinking in terms of the receptor is just another chemical also. So I started thinking in terms of, in the organic chemistry terms of, how can we attach this to this? So then we made another series of compounds based on the etorphine drugs, the Bentley drugs. Okay? So we, out of this, we got a compound that only labeled mu receptors. Then we got another compound that only labeled delta receptors. So now we had affinity labels where you could differentiate between mu and delta. And we published that in Science in 1981, I think. That was a big deal back in those days.
Yes.
So we labeled these compounds with tritium. And we used this fentanyl isothiocyanate, we called it, you know how pharmacologists like to put names on compounds, you know. We called it FIT, fentanyl isothiocyanate, or FIT. And the ones that labeled mu was a benzimidazole isothiocyanate, which we call BIT, BIT and FIT, the dynamic duo. And so we tritium labeled the fentanyl isothiocyanate, and then Werner was able to label the delta receptors with it, rigorously show that it was covalently bound, and that it was labeling the opiate receptor. Because if you put in a competing ligand to block the receptor, the drug didn't label it anymore. If you put in the mirror image of that form that didn't bind to the receptor, it labeled it. This is where the concept of the mirror images, one does it and one doesn't do it, came up. And then later we came up with a more potent fentanyl isothiocyanate, just a more potent derivative. And at one nanomolar concentration, 10 to the minus 9th molar, it depleted half of the receptors. And so then Werner used that to purify the delta receptor to homogeneity. So in doing so, being part of this, I had to learn some stuff about pharmacology. I had to learn what scattered analysis was. And so I started working my way into pharmacology. Then I was helped a lot by Phil Skolnick that I had mentioned earlier, who was working on the benzodiazepines, because, you know, data analysis for one target is, you know, by scattered analysis, is the same thing as data analysis of another target. You know, it's just a different system. And so I had to learn the, you know, competitive binding, non-competitive binding, and all of this pharmacology stuff. And it over a period of a few years. And so then as I began to get a more detailed, you know, knowledge base on what compounds bound to what and how they were analyzed pharmacologically for what they did, then I was in a much better position to start designing other compounds to do different jobs, different things.
And how did you decide which, how do you decide which compounds to design?
No matter what the molecular modeling guys tell you, it's still chemical intuition largely.
Chemical intuition.
Yeah, but to have chemical intuition, you have to have a pretty good base of knowledge already. You know, in these affinity labels I was talking about, the approach was, how do you know what to start with even? Mm-hmm. What we had to do is pick something, pick a compound that bound to the receptor, and then we had to put a reactive functional group on it. Well, there's a lot of different kinds of functional, reactive functional groups, and on a fairly large molecule like that, there's a lot of different positions you can put them on. Okay, we chose the synthetically easiest thing, so we didn't end up fighting a land war in Asia to label this, and then it didn't work. Well, ours worked, and a competitor of ours who was labeling it at a different position on the molecule, his didn't work. We were lucky.
Yeah.
We took we picked a very potent compound as the base, and then we were lucky to get our reactive functional group in the right position. Mm-hmm. But in general terms of how you pick what structure to make, you know, it depends on the situation, but usually you just start, it's to get the ideal, quote, ideal compound for whatever the task at hand is, it's successive approximations a lot. You know, well, we put the methyl group over here and it knocked the activity down. Well, let's take it from over here and put it over here. And this increases activity in some assay. So you keep, that's called structure-activity relations. It's a fundamental concept in drug design. You have to develop a structure-activity relationship in order to know, you know, how changes in chemical structure affect pharmacologic activity.
What's rational drug design?
Different people define rational drug design different ways. It's using your chemical my definition of it, well, using chemical intuition and all the tools available to achieve your goals, you know, mm-hmm. Using whatever appropriate tools are available for the particular job at hand. You might want to do, that's good enough.
Have your tools changed over time? Have your tools changed over time? Can you tell a story about technological change in your field?
The tools for chemical synthesis, they've changed a lot. And so this is another very interesting thing regarding the progression of the chemistry from Dr. Small's group to the present. Dr. Small, chromatography is a method of separating chemical mixtures. That hadn't been discovered yet in Small's early work. There were no spectra. So all they had was melting points and combustion analysis. And very talented people that knew how to crystallize compounds. And they almost always, when we go back and look at small samples that we have for one reason or the other, they knew when they were pure, almost all the time, by the melting point, by the this, that, and the other, the way they behaved in different, in crystallization and stuff like that. But as far as the structural elucidation, they didn't know for sure what the structure of metapon was, because it could either be a 7-methyl or a 5-methyl. It turned out to be a 5-methyl. That's what they thought it was, but they didn't prove it. Mm-hmm. It was unequivocally proved later.
Because of the development of technology?
Technology. Mm-hmm. So first came UV spectroscopy in the 50s, I think, in the 40s, and primitive chromatography in the 40s and the 50s, I think. I'm not sure about these dates. When I was in graduate school, we had chromatography. That was in the early 60s. We had column chromatography with different absorbents, like alumina, silica. We had thin layer chromatography, but by then that's a very, very powerful first analytical technique. You know, it's quick. It's very good at separation. It tells you whether you've got starting material, whether you've got a string of beads running. You know what thin layer chromatography is?
Jerry.
I was looking for Joe Brady.
Oh, okay.
Promised to meet me. Sorry to interrupt.
That's okay.
It tells you whether you've got a multitude of compounds, whether your reaction is working. It tells you purity and stuff like that. We had to make our own plates. Now you buy the plates. X-ray crystal structures is the ultimate weapon in terms of structural elucidation, you know, if you can crystallize it. When I was in school, X-ray was a Cecil B. DeMille's production, if you will. It took a long time, a lot of work. It took months. It could take months to get an X-ray crystal structure back. Now it takes a day or so. It's almost routine. We send the compound out. I tend to get off the track here. So X-ray has improved dramatically to where it's almost a routine. The NMRs is a very powerful nuclear magnetic resonance. It's like MRI. It's the same principle as MRI of human tissue, human developing pictures of humans' anatomy and stuff, and looking for diseases and stuff. But it's also applicable to small molecules, and it's a very powerful technique. The instruments when I started on in the 60s was a very primitive machine, you know. The electronics weren't that good. It didn't work well all the time and stuff. Now these things are just, and you had to use a lot of a relatively large sample. Now it's just a couple of grains of salt worth, and that's it, you know, and you run it in 5 minutes. You got a spectra, that, and then a few touches of the console, and you can get all these other measurements and stuff. So NMR has improved dramatically. We didn't have HPLC then when I started. That's high pressure liquid chromatography. That's developed, mass spec has developed dramatically. Now you can do chromatography coupled with mass spec. But you know, in all of these, this is in a way a double-edged sword, because all of these techniques, of chromatography and stuff, allow you to. You don't have to be as skilled an experimentalist as Small was, mm-hmm. for example. Mm-hmm. You don't have to crystallize stuff anymore. A lot of postdocs that come from different groups don't crystallize things anymore. They just purify them by fractional chromatography, evaporate the solvent, and there it is, you know.
Mm-hmm. So you think there's something lost?
It's a lost. It's a lost art. I mean, it's becoming a lost art. Crystallization is still important in process research, but in terms of the basic research and the first synthesis of a compound, you don't really have to crystallize it anymore. You know, a lot of people think you don't have to crystallize it anymore. Crystallization is a very powerful purification technique, and it's essential in certain we were talking about mixtures of right-handed and left-handed forms. Mm-hmm. The classical way of separating these right and left-handed forms, so you can study their pharmacologic properties individually, is by a crystallization of derivatives. Mm-hmm. That's called optical resolution. But that's being lost. As these analytical methods and these purification methods get better and better. Well, I try to teach all of my postdoctoral fellows how to crystallize stuff and the importance of it, and, you know, how it can help them and stuff. Of course, we, you know, when it terms, you know, MRI, I mean, when it comes to measuring biochemical function in living systems, like humans, MRI gives you a good picture, anatomical picture of the brain, picture of the organ.
Yeah, but
doesn't give you biochemical function, not classic MRI. There are adaptations of MRI that can give you biochemical function. They're just recently coming around, but back in the 1980s, one of the best techniques to get biochemical function was PET scanning, positron emission tomography. And the reason I mention this, and that's a recent development in terms of instrumentation and techniques and stuff. The reason I mention this is because we were the first to develop a compound that was a functional PET imaging agent for opioid receptors in the primate brain. Mm-hmm. This compound is known as cyclofoxy. Yes. Okay. And that name has there's a reason for that name. It's also pretty snappy. This compound was, we developed this compound. This is developing a research tool. The affinity labels that I was talking about were aimed towards purification of receptors. This is a compound that was aimed towards a PET, to be a PET ligand. So we had different considerations and, how to design this, but this was first published in 1984 in Febs, December of 1984, in Febs Letters, and it was it was a very advanced paper for that day, those days. So that was another tool. That was a tool that you can see. PET scanning is nice, but if you don't have the right ligand, you can't use PET scanning. In PET scanning, the drug goes and sticks on and binds to the receptors, and it emits radiation. Mm-hmm. So, with the way you analyze the emitted radiation, it can give you, and then electronically treating the data by the principles of computed tomography, you can come up with a cross section of the brain
right. That
will show you where this receptor is located.
So those images that NIDA uses are the outgrowth of that technique.
Yeah, if they're PET images.
Yes.
Well, it's extension of this.
Right.
But this was a big deal when we did this. We had a very, very rigorous proof that we were measuring opioid receptors too, because we did this study in baboons. You give the drug, you wait the proper amount of time, you do the imaging. And you see this area where a lot of counts have accumulated. If you then treat this baboon with a narcotic antagonist, it chases these counts away very quickly. If you treat with a narcotic antagonist and then do the experiment, you don't get any accumulation because the narcotic antagonist is blocking the sites. And we had showed that the pharmacologically active isomer of naloxone, the left-handed form, chased drug off the sites. But we had the mirror image form of naloxone that we had made by total synthesis, and that didn't have any effect. We knew it didn't bind to opiate receptors, so it shouldn't have any effect. And so...
Okay, so now tell me about opiate total synthesis.
Okay. In 1974, when I joined Everett May's group, this was the beginning of a severe worldwide opium shortage. And it was caused principally by three things. The first was President Nixon's war on drugs, in which Turkey ceased production of opium. Russia, that was one thing that shut down the supply of opium, that limited the supply of opium. Russia entered the world market for the first time as a buyer on the international market. And most our alternate source of opium was India and Turkey. But when Turkey ceased, it was mostly all India, I think. India had crop failures 2 years in a row. So the supply of raw material was very low. It got so low that it was getting difficult. It lasted for about 3 years. It was so low that it was difficult to get a prescription for Imprin 3, that was codeine with aspirin, for your toothache or your root canal filled in certain parts of the country. It got so bad that the U.S. federal government released about half of the opium in a strategic material stockpile. The government stockpiled like 80 some different commodities from different metals to opium, and opium was one, and stuff that, you know, if we went to war,
yes,
we didn't want to depend on anybody for this, because
yes,
we almost ran out of opium in the Second World War,
yes,
too.
Yes, and it was stockpiled then as well.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The morphine, mm-hmm, alkaloid will keep for decades, mm-hmm, and properly stored. But this pointed out that, so there was two things, really. It was a need for a total synthesis of morphine alkaloids independent of opium poppies. One, because of the opium shortage. And there's a book, this has been written about by a guy named Michael Schwartz. The name of that book is Prescription Drugs in Short Supply. He talks about the opium shortage, the reasons for it, how it was alleviated. And then there's the quinine cartel, and then there's other story, other write-ups of actual drug shortages or raw materials for drugs, prescription drugs. But then, this was in 1974 when the opiate receptor was first discovered. And see, since the opium poppy only makes the left-handed form, if you will, of these drugs, we wanted to have the unnatural, we wanted to study the other isomer, the right-handed form. Right-handed form is not available in nature. At first, there was no total synthesis available. Morphine and the opium alkaloids had been synthesized as an academic exercise, as I mentioned, and completed in 1952 by Marshall Gates, and then fully reported in 1957 or 1958 in his full paper. But this was an academic exercise where you could, with great exertion, you might be able to make a little dab of morphine like this, you know. This was a relay synthesis, basically, which means that they synthesized an intermediate. You can take opium and you can work backwards to a compound known as dihydrothebinone. And then, so all you got to do is synthesize dihydrothebinone once by total synthesis. Then you can use dihydrothebinone from opium, which is much, much easier available. So that's called a relay synthesis. So we needed a good synthesis whereby we could get the unnatural isomers to make grams of these compounds that we wanted to study in animals. But as I said, at first it wasn't a good synthesis. Any synthesis. So we started with an alkaloid known as cinnamonine, which is a rare alkaloid. It comes from a small philodendron-like plant that grows in Korea and the Orient. So you got to extract huge amounts of plant material to get this alkaloid material. It has the carbon skeleton, which is the mirror image of the opium alkaloid carbon skeleton, but it doesn't have unnatural morphine. But it can be converted by chemical synthesis. It actually had been in the 50s in low yield by Goto and Yamamoto in the 50s. What we did, Everett May, this was not my idea to do this from cinnamonine. This was Mario Aceto's idea from the Medical College of Virginia. He met with Everett May, with Lou Harris. Have you talked to Lou Harris?
I am tomorrow,
okay.
I think.
And they discussed, well, why not study unnatural morphine. Okay, how to get unnatural morphine. So Everett May we decided that we should start with cenominate. We should work on total synthesis, but since that could take several years, we should start get some of the material. So he got through Tanabe Pharmaceutical Company 50 grams of cenominate. They extracted a special extraction for us through Dr. Takeda, T-A-K-E-D-A, who was instrumental in getting this material. So we got the cenominate, and we converted it by chemical synthesis, semi-synthesis. It's when you start with a natural material and use it to convert to something else. So we made several grams of unnatural morphine, and we made 1 gram of unnatural naloxone, the mirror image form of the narcotic antagonist. And these compounds proved to be extremely valuable research tools to detect opioid receptor mediated effects. Now, you know, at this time, people were trying to figure out what effects and are mediated by opiate receptors and which ones aren't. Okay? Because this was all new. Now we had a receptor that we could measure. Well, one way to do that is put in the natural form. The natural form does this effect. Then put in the unnatural form. If the mirror image form doesn't do it, then it's good evidence that it's opiate receptor mediated. Then you can do the kind of like the flip side of that is you see you have this effect produced by morphine. You block it with naloxone, the antagonist, and then you take the mirror image form of naloxone. It doesn't act on the receptors, and this doesn't block it. That's added evidence that you're dealing with an opiate receptor mediated effect. So we published a paper in Science on plus morphine. This was, it was in 76 or 76, 77. Yasko Jacquet is the first author on that paper, along with myself, Ijima, Werner Klee, and Dick Streedy, I think. But then we recognized that these plus opiates were unnatural opiates, were valuable research tools, but the problem was cenominate wasn't that available. So this was another impetus to develop a total synthesis. Okay? So we wanted to get a total synthesis to be able to make as many grams of these unnatural opiates as we wanted to, and we wanted to get one whereby we could, it could be put into commercial production in order to either produce or supplement the production of opium alkaloids by chemical synthesis. Now, a lot of people had tried to develop such a synthesis. There were a number of academic groups worldwide working on this, 6 or 7 groups or something like that, some really serious organic chemistry groups. But I was working on this by myself. At first, there was after Everett May left and I retired from NIH, another fellow came in who was a medicinal chemist. His name was Arnold Brassey, and he wasn't really interested in drug abuse that much. He never came to the CPD. You don't have to write this, but there were several possible ways where you could develop a practical synthesis of morphine alkaloids. We attempted a biomimetic approach, which was unsuccessful. This is a process that mimics the biosynthesis in the opium poppy. And then after that we came up with some very nice chemistry and useful chemistry to make other compounds, but not to make morphine alkaloids. Then after that, I alone initiated a synthesis by a conceptually different approach, mm-hmm. which was an extension of the Greve, G-R-E-W-E, approach.
I'm sorry.
G-R-E-W-E. It's the man's name that developed the chemistry in simpler systems that formed the morphine and carbon nitrogen skeleton.
Okay.
But it was never they were never able to adapt it to morphine, the morphine alkaloids, because of chemical complications in the chemistry. Well, Without going into, you know, what, you know, the chemical stuff involved with this, I was able to get the Grave A approach to work for the morphine alkaloids. And so I worked on this for, you know, by myself, and I don't believe I'm almost certain I wouldn't have been able to do this if I hadn't had process chemistry experience. Mm-hmm. Because there were some very ingenious approaches developed by these academic groups, but they lost sight of the fact it can't be complicated. Because if it's complicated, it's going to cost more money to do, and it's not going to be prohibitively expensive. Mm-hmm. But in my case, I recognize this because I was trained in process chemistry. You know, I tell my postdocs, the ideal chemical reaction has no solvent, it produces no impurities, and it's finished after 1 second after mixing. You know. Impurities are the nemesis of the organic chemist. It's hard to get reactions to go that don't make impurities. So this is another thing I tell the postdocs, and I tell them what Rice's rule is.
That's Rice's rule?
No, Rice's rule says, very simple, if you don't make impurities, you don't have to take them out of your product. In other words, do clean chemistry, and you'll be far ahead of the game. So I was able to work out this total synthesis of morphine alkaloids using my knowledge, my experience in process, with no chromatography, with purification of a few of the some of the intermediates by crystallization. And I was able to set it up so you could get either the natural morphine alkaloids, or you could get the unnatural morphine alkaloids at will, in any ratio you wanted. By separately.
So I assume you're commercializing this.
This is being put into production now by a Mallinckrodt and Company. Mallinckrodt, Mallinckrodt. There's only a few companies in the United States that are allowed to import opium and process opium into medical narcotics for use, in the practice of medicine. Mallinckrodt is the largest. And the number of kilograms of Schedule II medical narcotics used in this country. It's about 110,000 kilograms of finished alkaloids and alkaloid derivatives. Now, when you consider opium's only got 10% starting material in it, or 12%, whatever, you're up there at almost 10 times that number of kilograms of opium. And when you think about, production of opium by lancing poppies, scraping each one off by hand, lancing them several times, and all of the stuff, the enormous amount of third world labor that's required to produce these compounds, it can be attractive to have an alternate production. And so if you look at the constituents of opium that are used to make medical narcotics, you have only three compounds, morphine, codeine, and thebaine. So any synthesis that gives morphine, codeine, and thebaine will give you allow the synthesis of the entire spectrum of medical narcotics derived from opium. So this synthesis that I developed allows you to make morphine, codeine, or thebaine. And it's been now extended to make it to be more direct and simple. It's hard to explain without going into chemistry. Well, there's one thing that I haven't mentioned. Morphine has an N-methyl group on the nitrogen atom. The substituent, the type of substituent on that N, on that nitrogen atom, largely determines the pharmacologic profile of the compound. Okay, if you take the methyl off and you put an allyl group on, a three-carbon unit on, then it becomes an antagonist. And so it's then it's then it becomes of interest to have the compound with nothing on nitrogen. Because if you have nothing, if you synthesize it by total synthesis with nothing on nitrogen, you can put anything on nitrogen at any stage of the synthesis to achieve the desired pharmacologic profile. So this synthesis was extended into the NH series also later. And this has been, I think we have, I've got 7 or 8 patents on this. I can't tell you the exact number. I think it's 7. These patents are listed in that review article that I wrote in the Marcia Meldrum's book. Mm-hmm. So one of my postdocs, Amy Newman, who is now a senior investigator, a section chief at NIDA Intramural Research in Baltimore. When she was in my group, she did a lot of the work on the extension of the opiate total synthesis, and she's on 1 or 2 of the patents that deal with that. So, and then there's been refinements to this synthesis at different times terms of separating the right-handed form of the left from the left-handed form of the intermediate, or making, okay, if you have an equal mixture of the right-handed and the left-handed form, if you separate them completely, you only get 50% of the one you want. Now we have methodology that was developed in Japan that allows us to make only one of them. If we want to make unnatural isomers, we use this particular catalyst and we only get the precursor to the unnatural isomers. If we want to make the natural isomers, we use the other catalyst and we get the precursor to the natural isomers.
So I'm assuming that this, you see this as your legacy. I mean, this is your contribution to the field, one of your major
works. This is it's a major probably my most important contribution. A lot of people have tried to do this since 1925, and this is the only practical synthesis out there. I first published this in 1980, and that's been 24 years ago. And groups continue to work on this, and there's been massive advances in organic in the art of organic chemical synthesis. But so far, no one's been able to come up with anything that even approximates this. And it's been characterized as being elegant in its simplicity.
I assume you like that characterization.
I do.
Okay, to kind of conclude, let's think about which of the other contributions will you be remembered for?
Development of the first functional PET ligand for for imaging receptors in the primate brain. Although some of the competing groups like to overlook the fact that we were the first. We weren't the first to do it in humans, but we were the first to do it in a primate brain. And this drug, cyclofoxy, has been in humans, and we published papers on human studies with cyclofoxy. Mm-hmm. We've done a lot of work with corticotropin release and hormone antagonist. Are you familiar with CRH and what it does?
No.
Corticotropin releasing hormone. This is part of the body's response to stress from any cause. Whether you have a fender bender in rush hour traffic when you're in a hurry, or whether you know, something stressful happens. It all works through the same mechanism. And corticotropin-releasing hormone launches a stress response. Okay. And acute stress, at least from an evolutionary standpoint, is a good thing because it allows you to survive a threatening, the organism to survive a threatening situation. But when you're primed up for, you know, you get the fight or flight. Mm-hmm. Your system is primed up for stress, you don't feel hungry anymore. You lose interest in activities that aren't related to survival. Your system starts to draw calcium out of the bones for mobilization, you know, and digestion shuts down, stuff like that. You're not hungry anymore. You know, like, when was the last time you saw somebody stop for a hamburger when somebody was chasing them with a baseball bat, you know, that type of thing. So chronic stress is bad. Acute stress can be good. Chronic stress is linked to inflammation. It's linked to heart disease. It's linked to a whole lot of bad stuff. Drug abuse is a form of stress. Withdrawal from drugs is a form of stress. And we think that from the drug abuse standpoint, CRH antagonist might be a good adjunct to detoxifying people, preventing relapse, to suppress the stressful events associated with drug withdrawal. And it's also, stress is involved in depression, anxiety, and a lot of other related, you know, there's a lot of types of anxiety and there's a lot of types of depression. I'm not a psychiatrist, but I know psychiatrists that talk about this. And so what we're trying to do, so we've come up with a lot of compounds. What we're aiming for, one thing we're aiming for is to be able to image CRH receptors in the brain. We've got a good start to that, image by PET scanning. So we can develop a ligand like cyclofoxy, only one aimed at CRH receptors. Then we can measure, do before and after experiments. You take a person that has anxiety, and then you treat them with an unlabeled CRH antagonist medication, and you look to see. Then you look with PET scanning to see if the receptors are normalized, because stress is known to downregulate the CRH receptors by as much as 20% in depressed patients who committed suicide. That's a study in 1989, I think. Charles Nemiroff, who's at Emory University. I think it was in 1989. They did autopsy. They took tissue out of autopsy tissue out of people that had committed suicide. They measured the receptors. These were depressed patients that committed suicide. Okay. Then they had matched controls that weren't depressed. Mm-hmm. And there was a 20%, they were the normals, there was a 20% reduction in the receptors for CRH in the depressed patients. And the assumption is that the brain is pushing out so much CRH that the body downregulates the receptors to try to compensate for the excessive amounts of CRH that the body is producing because of the depression. So we think we can measure that if we got the right compound.
So that's what you're working on now?
Now, yeah.
Great. Very, very interesting.
So
how do you decide, that's the sort of last question, how do you decide to do something like that? Where do you get the ideas
from?
How
do we decide to do CRH?
Yeah. Yeah.
Or how did we decide to develop the opiate total synthesis the way we decided? That was by necessity.
That I could see. Yeah. I can see the reasoning. But
how do we select CRH to work on and not dopamine D3?
Yeah.
Part of it is people that you you know and you've worked with in their interest. These guys will come to me and they will say, Kenner, we need a compound that does this or does that. We need a compound that first we need a CRH antagonist. Then we need a compound that's got it, that can be a PET ligand. And it can't be too lipophilic. It can't be, it's got to be just the right range of lipophilicity, et cetera. So you have to fine tune the structure. So why select CRH as a problem? CRH has only been around for 20 years when it was isolated from sheep brain. And the pharmacologic biochemical studies that have been coming in progress since then, by the guy that discovered CRH, Wiley Vail, has shown more and more that it's connected with anxiety, with serious diseases in humans. Chronic anxiety, chronic depression, and other disorders in humans that are now diagnosed by DSM-IV manual. You know, if you got 17 of the following 20, that's what you have. We hope to put this on a better basis and be able to diagnose it by saying your receptors are downregulated 20%, and if we know that from analysis of past data that if it's in this region of the brain, it's probably causing your depression type of thing. Mm-hmm. I'm not a psych physician, mm-hmm. but this is one thing that you can do with this. And it would be a tool that would be applicable to many types of disorders, you know.
Right.
Drug abuse, anxiety, depression, and there's a fairly long list of other disorders that are related to CRH. Either excessive amounts of CRH or where the CRH system is turned down too far. Mm-hmm. You've got a chronic affective disorder. Seasonal affective disorder. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. And there's some other ones that are related to too low an activity of the CRH system. So instead of an antagonist there, you might need a CRH agonist to turn the system up. And there are peptide compounds. Peptides are not good drugs. Mm-hmm. Because they get chewed up by proteases, they don't get into the brain well, et cetera. And what we would like to have is a CRH agonist as well as CRH antagonist. And we have CRH, and it's complicated further by the fact you've got CRH1 and CRH2 that could be roughly analogous to mu and delta, say, in the opiates. So we have no alkaloid ligands that for CRH2 at all. We have no alkaloid ligand that's a CRH1 agonist. We only got alkaloid-like ligands that are CRH1 antagonists. So really, we don't have but one out of the, you know, four types of compounds that we need. Like in the opiates, we got agonists and antagonists that are pretty much selective for both. For all.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I mean, you've given me a very...
We can talk on the telephone, too,
yes.
Later on if you want to call me up.
All right.
You can record what I have to say on the telephone if you want
yes.
to.
All right. Thanks.
And let me give you my telephone number.
Yes.
301-496-1856. And when I see this... the transcript of this, if there's something that's left out,
yeah.
I'll call you up and say, I think we ought to include this or that or what.
Great. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
I think it's Flora Gillam, G-I-L-L-A-M or I-M. I'll verify that.
All right. Thank you.
Okay.